What we have here is government by plutocratic authoritarians who have doled out millions in tax breaks and subsidies to wealthy families, then take food off the tables of poor families.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Gratitude goes out to you today for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is a locally made exploration into positive solutions to some of today's ecological challenges for all of us working to create a healthier future for our communities and for the world you live in.
Thanks for listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Teresa Wilkie. Thanks for tuning in to Eco Radio KC. Andres Bernal, educator, research, coach, and consultant, spoke in Kansas City on August 11th about the Green New Deal. On today's show, we will play from our recording of the event. Great information. Stay tuned. But first, the environmental news for the week of August 19th. Democracy Now! Reports, a Cornell University study finds that a global surge in methane gas emissions over the last decade is largely due to the fracking boom in the U.S. and Canada. The study finds the recent increase in methane gas emissions is massive, with chemical fingerprints indicating a large increase of leaked gas from shale drilling. Methane is far more potent than carbon dioxide at trapping heat in the atmosphere, and methane is the second largest greenhouse gas contributor. Yet another study finds tiny pieces of plastic pollution permeate the Earth's atmosphere, falling down to Earth in snowfall, even in the most remote corners of the globe. Researchers called for more studies on the effects of plastic pollution on human health. They cited a 1998 study that found inhaled microplastics may contribute to the risk of lung cancer. A group of 22 states, 6 cities, and the District of Columbia have sued the Trump administration last week in an attempt to block the rollback of Obama-era regulations on emissions from coal-fired power plants. This lawsuit claims the EPA has a duty under the Clean Air Act to limit carbon emissions. Also last week, the Trump administration finalized changes which roll back the Endangered Species Act. Regulators will now be allowed to factor in economic considerations when granting endangered status. Species classified as threatened will see their protections weakened, and scientists will be limited in setting climate change-related protections. Critics say the changes were made to clear the way for mining, drilling, and development projects in areas populated by protected species. The 46-year-old Landmark Endangered Species Act has saved over 99% of classified animals, plants, and insects since its inception. Environmental groups, Democratic lawmakers, and attorneys general have vowed to fight the changes. Bold Nebraska reports Canadian pipeline company TransCanada bribed a Nebraska County commissioner, offering a bonus of $49,000 if the commissioner worked well with them to see that its controversial proposed Keystone XL pipeline project was ushered through to completion. Kansas City Star reports Reno County in central Kansas experienced a shocking uptick in seismic activity this past week, 11 earthquakes in 5 days. It started with a magnitude 2.4 earthquake last Wednesday morning just 2.5 miles southwest of Hutchinson, Kansas. There would be 10 more before the week was out. The second came just before 8 a.m. on Friday. This was a magnitude 4.2 earthquake, which shook the area. More than 1,000 people reported feeling the quake across Kansas, Oklahoma, and Missouri. Now, our show. Andres Bernal talks about the Green New Deal.
So, without further ado, let's welcome Andres Bernal.
I wasn't quite sure what to expect when I got here. It's been interesting because I'm an immigrant from Bogota, Colombia. I got to the United States when I was 4 years old, and I spent my early childhood in the suburbs of Chicago, the Midwest. And then later in life, I moved to Texas. So So I think something interesting is kind of like this dual dynamic of a little bit Midwest, a little bit South, and all the great things that come with that.
Sure. I guess I'm going to start broad here and say 20 years past, the average global temperature has kept rising. How does that disrupt the economy, and how might that affect the daily life of ordinary Kansas cities?
Yeah, so when we hear from scientists who dedicate their lives to understanding and studying the effects of all of these forces in the atmosphere, carbon in the atmosphere, the way that's going to affect the ocean, the water, the food systems, and whatnot, we kind of get this idea of the trends that are happening. But sometimes missing from the conversation is the way that all of this is related to very important social issues. And so I think it's undeniable that we're going through a political and social crisis right now. You know, in this country and around the world, where we're seeing the rise of many far right-wing fascist movements, and we're seeing the rise of a very volatile and violent xenophobia and scapegoating people in the world. So we're seeing people migrate to other countries where there's opportunities. Especially, we're seeing the colonized world. You know, all the world that all throughout history was extracted of resources, was subjugated. These are all the people who are now looking for opportunities in other places, right? And these dynamics are only going to be exacerbated with climate change. As we see, many areas of the world are not going to be able to produce food in the same way. There are going to be water crises, and there's going to be a scarcity of water, especially when you have many corporations that are trying to privatize water itself and try to make a profit off of it. Of course, the places that are most vulnerable for all of this is the colonized world. So as we see more migration, as we see parts of the world being uninhabitable, we're also going to see the reaction of the far right, scapegoating, telling people, trying to manipulate the people who currently live in many parts of the world to believe that these other people are threats, they're an invasion, they're coming here. Recently, we experienced in this country, and for myself growing up in Texas, a tragedy with this, this white nationalist terrorist who, is very vocal about the influence of a rhetoric embodied by the president around stopping an invasion. And many people feel like they're being hunted down. So it's a very serious situation. And as we've seen throughout history, when people feel like there's scarcity, when people feel like it's I have to take care of me and my own to survive, and leaders exploit these beliefs and emotions, we've always seen the rise of totalitarian governments, of fascism, and sadly, of human rights violations. Atrocities that some people may think that this is sort of the past, but I believe that we are all capable of very dark things, and it's up to us together to bring out the best in one another and make sure we keep these dark forces at bay.
I'm encouraged then by seeing so many people here in Kansas City encouraged to act on defending the neighbors who may not have all the papers. How we talk about every ice raid that's happening here in town. That's important for us to draw a line and say, unacceptable. We have to stand up for these people so that we stay connected. We understand that these are people who work hard, who live with little, and people like them on the other side of the world are picking our citrus, right? Are providing us our food. And if they don't have stability in their lives far away, what about me? I'm not going to be able to go to the grocery shop, right?
Absolutely. I mean, so much of what is often taken for granted is hidden from plain sight. And when you kind of peer through the veil, you see that there is all of this work that's necessary. People day in and day out, that includes people of all different ethnicities and races, people that that were born here and whose ancestors have been here for a very long time, who have just gotten here. One of the most effective ways to keep populations under control is, of course, to make them feel like you know, we have to be fearful, threatened by one another, when in reality there is just so much obscene concentrations of power in so little hands. And we have much more in common than often we're told we do.
Absolutely. And as I just now that I just had this conversation, I'm just now realizing how privileged I've been. I've never looked at my food and actually thought of food when I put it there.
How weird. How absurd.
And we should, right?
Yeah.
And also, you know, the kinds of what it's like to live as a person who's creating and these food systems, making this food. What are their lives like? You often hear people say, you know, there's been a fight to raise the minimum wage all across the country, and one of the common responses from a more right-wing perspective is to say, well, why should somebody, you know, doing this or doing that?
Yeah, you know, what have they done to deserve that, you know, plan to handle it, right?
Exactly, right? So I think this is about asserting the dignity of, you know, our labor. And our skills, that no matter, you know, where we set this socially destructive ideal of what it means to be a skilled laborer, because I think, you know, this is kind of arbitrary sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, we're all just trying to live our best life and take care of our families and do the best we can. And so wherever you are, you know, I think there's something, you know, very special and dignified about just kind of doing what you're about to do. Yeah, I think it's a very big part of where a lot of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's political brilliance comes from, the time that she spent in the service industry, because you're working with people every day, you know, different kinds of people, you're meeting a lot of different kinds of needs, you're feeling the pressure from an industry that has made it very difficult for people in the service industry to just kind of get by.
We're seeing inequity all the time, everywhere we look, if we just look. I'm trying to illustrate a worst-case scenario, so we maybe make that part of our dialogue, but there are so many other different ways that to enter the Green New Deal, to enter climate action as a conversation. So let's get right to the GND. It's very complicated. I think one of the questions that we've had for many months now is a resolution now. What is it, and how does it become actual policy? So, do you want to walk us through the actual?
Sure. I think that the Green New Deal, you know, is both this political ideal, this project, and also exists as this very real kind of process of legislation that at the moment is a non-binding resolution. The inspiration for the Green New Deal, drawing from many of the insights that happened during the New Deal, when our world economy had completely collapsed, when Nazis were rising, fascists were rising all over the world, it was a very scary time. You know, our entire capitalist economy was, you know.
I'm sorry, that is something that we also forget. My generation doesn't even realize democracy was under threat.
Democracy was under threat
because the economy had collapsed.
Right. And, you know, as I'm speaking about it, when people feel like that scarcity is upon them, you know, as human beings, we react in certain ways. We become very vulnerable to
tribalism.
Yes, or authoritarians, or, you know, the illusion of law and order through kind of discipline and these kinds of things, right? And so drawing from many of these inspirations, what did we do? You know, there wasn't really an economy. We found a way to mobilize ourselves through the help of social movements, very many political movements that were putting constant pressure on political leaders, through the help of also very visionary policymakers and thinkers who wanted to break away from any of the orthodoxies that have governed what's considered acceptable in terms of what we can propose in policy-wise. These things started coming together, and we were able to mobilize ourselves through a Great Depression and through a Second World War and the rise of fascism to rebuild the kind of social democracy that we now, you know, experience. which includes all of these things like a 40-hour work week and weekends.
These are all things that are completely still in place. You know,
right.
What narrative is out there?
Social Security.
Right. We still live in a liberal social democracy.
I mean, we were able to, you know, to construct a more humane society. It was also imperfect. And I think that, you know, the way you see all of the steps forward that we took during that period were met by more steps forward than were met, because we've seen the civil rights movement happen as a consequence of kind of the political climate. And when we look around and we start to see all of these gains are being made, but what about, why are these communities being excluded? What is the history here? Right? So we start making more demands. And I think that's kind of the way that it works. So drawing from these lessons, from many of the limits of these first experiments, we now are kind of looking at the situation in a similar way. It is up to us to mobilize as if we were going to war, except the war is kind of with ourselves and with the world that we've created that is jeopardizing all of our well-being.
The way of life we live.
The way of life.
Account for all costs, the true costs.
Exactly. That also has taken for granted an industry that has thrived and become incredibly powerful at the cost of all of our well-being. And so it poses this question in that context, and it looks at something like the mission to the moon. We didn't know how we were going to go. We didn't know if we had the technology. We didn't know if we were going to be able to do it. We had no idea, but we committed to it. We set the goals. We said, we're going to do this. We're going to invest in technology. We're going to invest in the intellectual, creative capacity of people to come up with the how, and then we did it. And so in a very similar way, facing threats, facing scarcity, facing all of these problems, facing, you know, the idea that maybe we don't know all of the details of how we're going to do this, we are now proposing to mobilize ourselves and build a new economy, build a new energy infrastructure that, you know, basically makes fossil fuel obsolete, and in the process creates a more just and equitable society for all of us.
Yeah, I got a text message right before this from my dad. Good luck with your meeting. Sorry, I am not there. He's a skeptic.
He's the skill vapor we're talking about. And he says, well, you want to go all electric. Where do you get the electricity? You know, he sets traps. And he means well. He wants to challenge me, though, definitely. But I haven't had an opportunity to really tell him about what our past is, what the reality is. We got here today not knowing that we would get here, not knowing that we would have gone to the moon, not knowing that we would have all the social programs we have. We just said we want it.
You know, so that actually, I do answer that. I'm like, I don't know. I don't know the answer. We'll find out. Let's just agree that we want to have all renewable electricity and have electric vehicles. How about that? And does anyone know a skeptic like that or have that conversation? I wonder if we all can think about that too. Like, we can just smile back at these folks and calm them down and assure them we'll do it. And that happened at the last town hall we had in April too. We had someone saying, what do we do? If this will help us, you know, and all I can say is keep coming here.
Yeah, I think questions are important. Questions are healthy. To say, how is this going to happen? That's important. And many of us that are, you know, trying to figure these things out and working towards these issues are asking ourselves the same questions. But I think the difference is where we start to go into the realm of cynicism. And oftentimes I think because our culture and the way that, you know, the social order exists thrives off of, you know, kind of keeping people very cynical about anything ever changing. And a lot of ways that can suck the hope or the imagination out of a lot of people's spirit. And so, you know, I really like this notion that we create hope with actions. You know, we don't necessarily have to start with all the answers with hope, but as we come together, as we make our moves, as we start proposing things, as we start giving our vision, putting our vision forward, people start to feel that hope, and that propels more action and more creativity. And we know, I mean, there are brilliant engineers in the world out there, in our country, who just have never had the opportunity to put their ideas into practice.
What do you think is harder or the bigger challenge? The technological advances that we need to have a carbon-free economy, or the social, political?
I think it's definitely the social and political.
That's what I would ask. Because I don't want to take for granted that the technology is there. But that is the narrative we get a lot from AFC, from other candidates. They say it's there, and I believe them.
Yeah.
But we look like that. We have a lot to go on.
And, you know, everything from the media to the way so many academic departments across universities have kind of held this orthodoxy that tells us this is the way it is, this is what's possible, and any venturing out of here has been causing total collapse of everything. And you know, they people like to point to, you know, hit the Venezuela button or be like, oh, something, you know, you have a collapse, right? And oftentimes what's not considered is all of these examples are usually examples of countries that have been colonized or are currently being, like, aggressively experiencing some kind of very imperialistic situation, or in some kind of after-Catholic war where their entire capacity was disseminated. You know, yeah, sure, that's where you're going to see all of these very, very difficult situations. And so, you know, these examples are kind of used as pop-ups a lot. Really,
that's an excellent point too, that they're pointing to. I've never said this to someone too, they pointed that as well. I'm like, do you understand? Did you compare the United States with Venezuela just now? You know, that's why I would ask some folks like that. That's a very excellent country that has
well, yes, sir.
So now we live in a country that has a lot of democratic ideals that have been tested for centuries and will continue tested, and we can't test them. We can't have hope that they'll make it through.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, in addition to that, you look at the history of Latin America and the role of many other countries to put these Latin American countries in situations that they're in. So, you know, for me, it's kind of like, as we create a better society here for us, we're also in solidarity working with the rest of the world to create a better society for them. Because I think this kind of vision of internationalism is the only way that we're going to overcome climate change, because it will take the whole world to overcome. You know, we might be in phase one when we're talking about a Green New Deal here, but ultimately this is going to take the entire world coming together, reimagining a lot of things that we do and how we relate to one another to accomplish this. Because as people come together locally, networks begin to link up that may start a region and a state. You know,
let me throw an example like the Sunrise
Movement. There you go.
Absolutely. Yes. Very strong hubs in Boston and in other parts of the country, and this is like one of the strongest hubs in the middle of the country, if not the strongest hub. And it all started with people just networking, social media, yes, and finding each other, sharing
some politics.
Yes.
Can I close with this?
Please.
Yeah, so a little bit more about the Green New Deal to better answer your question. So, you know, with this context of the New Deal and those lessons and whatnot, you know, what we're proposing now is not just one bill or one legislation, but an entire decade or more of bills and legislations that begin to fill in these important gaps that we have, that mobilize these resources under certain principles. So we want a completely carbon-neutral economy by 2030, or as soon as we possibly can. We want to do this by investing in millions of jobs. Right? We want to break away from this binary that is either the environment or the economy. And, of course, many skeptics and many people on the right like to present these two things of like, we're going to destroy the economy if you do anything about climate change. And so, drawing from these lessons, we say, no, we have the capacity to use industrial policy to create jobs, give people good union jobs, and a job guarantee to get people in their communities involved in creating value. So, massive investment in jobs, building the infrastructure for this green economy is the third point, guaranteeing certain kind of rights, right to clean air, right to clean water, updating all of our environmental regulation, legislation, that many is very, most of it is very outdated. We haven't seen updates to it since the early 90s in a lot of these cases. There are new pesticides, new toxins, new chemicals that are out there, and the regulators don't really, you're kind of overwhelmed, so we need to update these things too. And then lastly, be very conscious of pushing for a just transition, or understanding, as you mentioned a couple times, that we cannot address environmental problems without seeing the way that our relationship to the environment, because that's what this is about. It's about our relationship to the earth and to these ecosystems. Because we are coming together, we're forming these economies, we're provisioning things for ourselves, we're producing, we're distributing and whatnot. That is always coming into contact with the natural environment. Right? And so that has created many social inequities that are necessary to maintain and this destabilization of many ecosystems. So being conscious of that, seeing why is it that certain communities experience higher rates of asthma? Why is it that certain communities are the ones that get all of this pollution focused and dumped in it? Why is Larry Summers one of the most powerful economists the world writing memos at the World Bank suggesting that it makes economic sense to move all pollution to Latin American countries because that's how you create equilibrium in the market, right? These are the things that we need to be conscious of, here locally in Kansas City, how the housing crisis, health disparities, all of these things, low wages, these things are all connected. So those are the key points there that through a series of legislations we're going to start to address. And I think that the first step is to begin to look at massive investments in infrastructure, getting these jobs going, getting the jobs guaranteed, and getting the process going in that.
So this one last thing to bring it back to KC. One thing that our legislative committee learned was the fact for example, to have this roadmap for climate action and a whole staff of leadership in the city manager's office that says, yes, we're going to do that, we want to do that. And you say, okay, what did you do last year? And they say, well, none of that actually, because we don't have a staff. We don't have the money, there's no budget to hire people to do the work to make these things happen. So, there's a potential there. There's a real opportunity if we just start acting locally on our local governments, local leaders, to say, this is a priority for us. What are you going to do? And there's a way they can keep kicking up the chain, right? City governments have put pressure on federal representatives to
yes. Programs. So this is kind of what's important and very cool about the Green New Deal. It's meant to use everybody's best capacities on every level. So there are experts who are going to come up with, like, these are the technological solutions we need. But the Green Deal can't be successful if it's not taken into account what are the specific local needs of all different communities. The purpose is to design it to increase democracy, to enhance the democratic control that people have over their government. Because then, what are we doing if we're not doing that, right? Part of this mission is also to democratize government itself, to make it something that's more relatable and in control to people. And so, for the Green New Deal to be successful, we have to know who needs what. We have to know where are our resources, what resources are where, how are the regions different. And so, a big part of the Green New Deal is going to require different communities coming together, finding out, keeping track of what are our biggest environmental concerns, how do they connect to our social inequalities, what resources do we have here, what labor do we have that is unutilized, and getting that conversation going and then starting to put pressure. And the more we do that, the easier it is for people at the federal government to have a map of what to do, and then that's where, you know, the interesting economic stuff comes in, which I think we'll talk about a little later.
Yes, so is this what you're talking about when you first met about what we need information?
Yes.
Yes, okay. We will take a little 15-minute break.
You've been listening to Andres Bernal, who was in Kansas City on August 11th speaking about the Green New Deal. We're going to have a break and come back right after these messages.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2015, Pope Francis issued a letter urging the world to act on climate change and protect those who are most vulnerable.
He asked us to consider both the cry of the poor and the cry of the planet.
Franciscan Friar Michael Lasky says the message inspired him and his fellow friars to find a new use for 80 acres of land near Baltimore, Maryland. For years, they had leased it to a farmer who grew corn and soybeans using industrial methods that deplete soil nutrients and compact the earth.
I took a walk out into the middle of our farmland, and it was like walking on concrete.
In Lasky's region, climate change is causing more heavy downpours and dangerous flooding. He says compacted soil makes the flooding worse because water runs off the fields rather than being absorbed into rich, fertile ground. So the friars decided to transform their land. Now they lease most of it to an organic farmer who grazes cattle sustainably. And on 3 acres, they created their own small farm. They planted cover crops to replenish the soil. And they started growing food, which will be donated to a soup kitchen in Baltimore. So, inspired by Pope Francis, they're helping feed the poor and nurture the earth. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Most times, KKFI moves against the stream. But just saying, play KKFI to your smart speaker will bring our stream to you. KKFI, wherever you are.
Hello, this is Joseph Jackson, host of Cowtown Conversations, where we discuss the matters that impact your life as a resident of the Kansas City metropolitan area, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m., right after Marcus Sinnell. Tune in for our next episode as we continue our conversation on crime, and our guest will be Merrill Bennigan, who's with the Office of Civil Complaints for the Kansas City Police Department. So join us on Cowtown Conversations, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m., right after Marcus Sinnell.
Some big fish to fry in Midwestern rivers on this current cast. Bighead and silver carp can grow up to 4 feet long and gobble up food that native fish rely on. These invasive fish are in the Mississippi, Missouri, and Illinois rivers. And if they get into the Great Lakes, they could do enormous damage. John Detmers of the Great Lakes Fishery Commission says one strategy for keeping these massive carp out of the lakes is to find a place for them on our plates. The fish are considered a delicacy in Asia, but have never really caught on as food in the States. Detmers thinks chefs and marketers could change that.
Being able to find ways that people can enjoy the fish would be a great way to reduce the risk of bighead and silver carp getting into the Great Lakes.
Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
And you're listening to Eco Radio KC, and I'm Dave Bennett Freeling, your engineer tonight, and we're listening currently, or on this program, to Andres Bernal, who is a political advisor and economist working with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez right now, and focusing on letting people know more about the Green New Deal. And we'll get back to his discussion with Kevin Grooms, which took place last week at Unity Temple. And in just about 26 minutes, we'll be listening to the Fiesta Musical. So stick around for that, and tune in next week, where we'll be having a live interview with Paul Hawken. And if you have any questions to add to our mix of questions for Paul, you can email us at ecoradiokc@gmail.com. Thanks again for tuning in. Back to our listening to Andres Bernal.
There are people
people here do not know what it's the Green New Deal.
It's a series of legislations and a political movement that we're all a part of to accomplish certain goals. I think that's the key part. We're trying to accomplish certain goals, and there's a structure for that. We're trying to accomplish these goals, which is basically to have a 100% renewable economy that is able to meet the agenda of not allowing the world to warm beyond 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the mid-century. So, the United Nations came out with a report. They said, if we go over 2 degrees Celsius by 2050, we're screwed. So, we can't let that happen. So, that's why we need to start acting now to transform our energy system to start to massively reduce carbon dioxide going on into the atmosphere. So, we need a completely 100% renewable energy system in this country. So, that's one of the goals. How are we going to do that? Well, we often get this point that there's no way to accomplish that without destroying the economy. And what that means for me, and I think for progressives, is that we don't want to destroy working people's lives. Because that's what destroying the economy means to me. For other people, oftentimes it means disrupting profits. So we have to be clear about that, I think. So that's why the Green New Deal wants to accomplish this through massive investment and job creation. Because this renewable economy needs to be built. Who's going to build it? We're going to build it. And we're going to get paid for it. And we're going to have good union jobs to build it. And we're going to have the right to dignified work. So that's the goal. That's the model, right? And it needs creativity. Because now we're going to push these legislations forward. How are we going to accomplish these goals? So that's the starting point. We have goals that we need to accomplish. We need to stay below 1.5 at max 2 degrees Celsius. We're going to do that by creating a 100% renewable energy economy. We're going to do that by creating massive amounts of jobs, putting people to work, building things. And we're going to do that conscious of the legacy of violence and injustice against various communities and working people in the country. So the resolution set the framework for that. If you read it, it starts by acknowledging that climate change is real and it's a crisis and an emergency. Because unfortunately, we've been in a situation where one party doesn't even accept that it's real. That's been difficult. While the other party, for the most part, has provided very underwhelming solutions to this and led kind of a vision that we can somehow accomplish this by creating incentives for markets, and that maybe eventually, slowly, the industry, the fossil fuel industry, will just like become renewable with the invisible hand. That's really kind of the approach that we've had so far. And it's failed. And it's going to fail. And we're not going to be able to accomplish this goal of staying below 1.5 or 2 if we approach it this way. So the Green New Deal as a resolution had to start a conversation by saying, it's a crisis, it's an emergency, it's real, we need to act. And when we act, we're going to act by creating jobs, we're going to act by creating infrastructure, we're going to be good jobs, we're going to secure Medicare for all of these things. Creating that framework is a job resolution. And so now it's all of our job and responsibility and duty to continue pushing these politicians and pushing our leaders and pushing ourselves to ensure that the bills that make things happen start to happen within the next 5 to 10 years. Our country and our society has kind of atrophied its ability to organize because we've had 50 or so years of a entertainment consumer-based culture that tries to get us to forget that politics involves organizing. It involves getting to know who's in your community. It involves being aware of the injustices that are happening in your community that maybe people think that this is just normal, this is the way it is. No, it's possible that many people think, well, gentrification is just the way it is. There's no other way to do it. If we're going to have nice things, we got to do it this way. And that's not true, right? So I think becoming aware of these things, starting to learn and figuring out, in my community, in my state, in my region, are there certain health risks, health factors that are happening? Is there an agenda to do fracking? Is there fracking in my region? Are there pipelines that are getting pushed forward? Are there asthma rates or health rates that are happening? Is an issue polluting a certain part of the region or the city, the state? These are the things we have to know about. Once we get the city council to say, we support a Green New Deal, we move on to the next thing. We keep organizing. We keep coming together. As I mentioned before, we need to find out, what are the environmental problems that are happening here in my community? That takes some research. We've got to find out. And we've got to do that work. We got to come together. And as we're organizing, as we're trying to spread awareness, as we're creating events like these, as we're pressuring our local leaders to pass the legislation, we have to be conscious of whether our organizations that are organizing is representative of our regions. Because that's been a big problem in the country. Of course, there's a history of segregation and violence that's created that way. We have to overcome that. We have to put in the work to say, we have to bring everybody together and build those relationships even when it's difficult. We have to reach out to communities that traditionally don't talk to one another.
Does the same way focus on building a 100% carbon-free economy when you start including a jobs guarantee in the program?
Sure. So one of the big ways that I was able to work with Congresswoman Ocasio Cortez and my part of that project was with this job guarantee idea. And if we go back to, for example, the civil rights movement and March on Washington, a big part of that effort wasn't just to talk about the injustices of racism in a vacuum, but understand the way that that is connected to unemployment and economic discrimination and the way that our cities are built. And so the civil rights movement had an agenda for the right to a dignified job for everybody. That as a country, we can make that happen. We have a responsibility to make that happen. That unemployment is an arbitrary concept that has been created, and we've just kind of accepted it. They've imposed that on us to expect that unemployment just happens. And many of the people in charge of many of our institutions will say things like, once you start getting below 4 or 5% unemployment, we're going to go into crisis, so we can't do that. We've always got to keep around 3 or 4% unemployment. That's millions of people that don't have jobs. And we often don't think about the way unemployment affects communities, affects schools, affects families, affects health, places this burden on people's mental health, these skills people, all kinds of things, right? So for me, a big part, before I even got active in the Green Deal, before the Green Deal became a policy proposal itself, this idea was a very important one, of having a jobs guarantee economy. So what does that look like? Well, while on one hand we're trying to decarbonize our economy through infrastructure, we also want to provide a baseline, dignified living wage for anybody that wants work. We're going to say we have the capacity, the United States government has the capacity to guarantee that everybody gets a job. So what does the United States government have that state governments don't have? They have the power of the purse. United States government has the ability to provide financing for this project. The cool thing about the jobs guarantee is that it says local community groups, local communities, regional communities are the ones that are going to implement the program, come up with the jobs. So the federal government provides the financing, guarantees the money to come in, and communities on the local level will say, these are the jobs that we need, these are the jobs that we propose. So it emphasizes democracy, it emphasizes organizing, it emphasizes this kind of theme that I've been speaking to around finding out, what do we need here, what are our issues? And so when we think about the jobs guarantee, we're also talking about jobs that aren't reliant on heavy fossil fuel usage. So there's so many things that we could be doing, from tutoring to regenerative agriculture to urban community farming, to arts projects and programs, sports, addressing the food debt. deserts that exist around the country, putting people in staff in nonprofits that need more help with the work that they do, encouraging social entrepreneurship to happen, right? So many things. When we think about the New Deal, there were arts group projects, environmental needs, community needs, social needs. We're going to provide work at a living wage, you know, say it's 15. I think it needs to be higher at this point, maybe like $20 per hour living wage. And anybody that's willing to work, we're going to have a job that will fit jobs for the person. And so that's kind of like a baseline of what we think society should guarantee people. It's part of the idea of the economic bill of rights that Roosevelt and many after him were pushing for, to say that we have a right to health care, and as well we have political rights, we have the bill of rights, right? But in addition to that, to be able to give meaning to our political rights, we also affirm that we deserve a right to health care, we deserve a right to housing, we deserve a right to an education, and we deserve a right to a dignified job.
So do you think the jobs guarantee is one giant massive bill that goes through Congress?
So I think we already have a lot of infrastructure, especially in the nonprofit world, that's not being utilized to its full potential.
Okay.
And so, you know, we'll do something like we'll take all these unemployment offices and we'll convert them to employment offices.
Mm-hmm.
We'll create the infrastructure that they need to work together with nonprofits to be able to do a lot of the things that we already want to do and just give them the resources to do it. And how come the place where we spend the majority of our time, which is a job, has zero democracy whatsoever? And how come we oftentimes live under conditions of authoritarianism in our workplace? So I'm very interested in this idea of solidarity economy, economic democracy, and expanding democratic participation in the economy itself. One of the things I came across a lot was that many cooperatives are kind of stuck in these little niches or small sectors across the country. And they kind of stay there, and they'll grow, they'll disappear, they'll grow, this has kind of been happening throughout history, with exceptions of moments where there was strong investment. One of my missions has been to push for an education project around the way that public finance actually works. And so much of these conversations around the deficit and the debt and where we're going to find the money is, you know, reactionary conservative hysteria that has moved us in the wrong direction. Because you never hear this when they talk about open war. They just do it. They just pass a bill, and all of a sudden all this money appears. They don't do this when we talk about tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires. It just happens. So why don't it's only for us that all of a sudden, you know, we got to, like, find this money to see. And so once we understand that the thing that limits what our government can spend on is not revenue, but it's resources, it's real resources. The thing that limits our government's action is inflation, and the limits to inflation are limits of resources. If we overspend where there's not the work, where there aren't enough workers, where there aren't enough things or technology, then you start running into a problem. But this is a country that has a lot of resources and a lot of underutilized resources. So when we talk about Medicare for All or free college or a Green New Deal, what do we want to spend on? Do we have the people, the capacity, the buildings, the infrastructure, the material, the technology, the know-how? It is our government's responsibility, it's our society's responsibility to spend in things that are going to improve our lives, improve working people's lives, and meet environmental and social needs in a way that the for-profit capitalist sector cannot and won't.
Here's the calendar of events for the week of August 19th. Today, Monday, August 19th, the Future of Farming and Food Town Hall has a program which started at 6 p.m., but it ends at 8, so there's still time to go. West Wyandotte Public Library, 1737 North 82nd Street, Kansas City, Kansas. Panelists will include Dorothy Barnett of the Climate Energy Project, Catherine Kelly of Cultivate KC, Gail Fuller of Fuller Family Farms. Facilitating the panel will be Stu Schaefer of Sustainability Agriculture Program, Johnson County Junior College. This is hosted by Kansas Rural Center. On Tuesday, August 20th, 6:30 to 8 p.m., Nonviolent Action Planning Meeting hosted by Extinction Rebellion, Kansas City, will be at Jacob's Well Church, 1617 West 42nd Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Wednesday, August 21st, the Kansas City, Kansas Local Chapter Meeting of the Kansas Green Party will be 6 p.m. at Freebirds World Burrito, 6029 Metcalf Avenue, Overland Park. This will be a public meeting of the Kansas City, Kansas Greens. Also on August 21st, Heading for Extinction and What to Do About It will be at 7 p.m. at Jacob's Well Church, 1617 West 42nd Street, Kansas City, Missouri. This is Extinction Rebellion in Kansas City. All are welcome to hear this important presentation. Saturday, August 24th, Sunrise Project's 5th Annual Pie Auction will be 5 to 8 p.m. at Hobbs Park, 702 East 11th Street, Lawrence, Kansas. Sunrise Project, a nonprofit using the vehicles of food and environment to create social change and equity, is having their beloved summertime tradition, the Community Potluck, and all are invited to enjoy. On Monday, August 26th, Healthy and Resilient Kansas Forum, Mapping the Connections, will be 1 to 5 p.m. at the Lawrence Public Library Auditorium, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. There'll be a Kansas Environmental Leadership Networking Mixer at Merchants Pub and Plate after. This is sponsored by the Climate Energy Project. Questions, email takeaction@climateandenergy.org or call Rachel Masilvi, 785-764-2055. Tune in next week and listen to our interview with Paul Hawken, an environmentalist, entrepreneur, journalist, and author of books including Drawdown and Blessed Unrest. These items and more can be found on our Eco Radio KC program page at kkfi.org and on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page.
Elephants are helping to fight the climate crisis. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The Environmental Protection Agency ordered the city of Newark, New Jersey, to begin issuing bottled water to residents facing high levels of lead in home tap water, a problem that may have been occurring for months and possibly years.
Last fall, officials who had long denied that the city had a widespread problem reversed course and gave away tens of thousands of water filters. But according to the EPA, lead levels exceeded the federal standard in several samples even after the filters have been distributed.
The New York Times reports that environmental and health advocates have criticized city officials for failing to address the problem, which was first noticed about 10 years ago in samples from city schools.
Children under 6 in Newark have shown higher levels of lead than in any other New Jersey municipality.
Last Monday, officials began offering bottled water to about 15% of the city's households. However, the Natural Resources Defense Council, which is suing Newark, wants it to be distributed to all 285,000 residents.
The lead is coming from service lines that connect homes to water mains, although plumbing in homes may also be contributing. Scientists agree there is no safe level of lead in water, and its presence can impair child brain development and damage other organs.
Dogs are dying across the U.S. from algal blooms. Three succumbed in North Carolina after swimming in a pond infested with algae, and another canine trio died in Austin, Texas, after swimming in a lake earlier this summer.
The Sacramento Bee reports that California officials have issued an advisory about toxic algal blooms as they've been spotted up and down the state.
Stagnant ponds and lakes with fertilizer or septic runoff are a sure breeding ground for the algae, which can look like scum, foam, or pea soup.
The algae create neurotoxins that can attack the nervous system of both people and their pets. Dogs drink the affected water or lick it off their coats, ingesting the toxins where they can cause symptoms in minutes.
Dangerous blue-green algal blooms are a major problem all over the United States, and it's expected to worsen as the climate warms.
Tidal wetlands along the coast of Washington, Oregon, and Northern California are critical habitat for a variety of wildlife, including young salmon and steelhead, migratory birds, and shellfish. But these estuaries are disappearing.
A new study led by NOAA shows that about 85% of the coastal wetlands have been lost after more than a century of development that has erased them, especially around major river deltas.
Some areas were diked, drained, or otherwise cut off from the sea for agriculture or other development. San Francisco Bay has lost more than 80% of its original vegetated tidal areas, and up north, the Columbia River estuary has lost more than 70%.
The study, using lasers that measure reflected light, also called LIDAR, showed that the estuaries extended far beyond where they now exist. No other such study has been done in the country.
Conservationists warn that estuaries are important not only to protect wildlife, but also to absorb high tides and reduce flooding.
The African forest elephant is often referred to as a gardener because as they forage, eating fruit from a diversity of trees, they disperse seeds over long distances. The seeds germinate, adding new plants that support primates, birds, and insects.
But according to a new international study, the animals provide another remarkable benefit: carbon sequestration.
That's because the elephants prefer to eat small, fast-growing trees, making room for slower-growing ones to access water and light.
Those slower-growing trees have much denser wood that stores more carbon than the thinner, faster-developing species. Without elephants nurturing those slow-growing trees, the study says more carbon would accumulate in the atmosphere, worsening climate change.
But the African forest elephant is an endangered species, being slaughtered for ivory trade, and their numbers are declining. If they go extinct, the study suggests Central African forests may release the equivalent of multiple years of CO2 emissions from most countries.
On the other hand, the authors say, conservation of the species could represent, in monetary terms, a carbon storage savings of $43 billion. And finally, the largest urban farm in the world is set to open on a rooftop in Paris, and its designers hope it will serve as a model to be used around the globe.
Fast Company reports that large rooftop farms are not new. One in Chicago measures 75,000 square feet, and another in Brooklyn is a bit smaller. But the new one in Paris will be more than 150,000 square feet on top of a six-story exhibition building that's being redeveloped.
Its size makes it likely to be profitable, something that's been difficult for smaller facilities, according to one of the farm's designers.
The farm will be tended by 20 gardeners using entirely organic methods, and The Guardian reports it's expected to produce about 1,000 kilograms of fruit and vegetables every day in the high season.
The produce from the farm will feed Parisians across the southwest part of the city, reducing the distance that food has to be transported. Additionally, locals will be able to lease small vegetable plots of their own.
The rooftop facility will use aeroponics, in which dangling plant roots are nourished with a mist that delivers nutrients and water. It's a closed water system with no soil, and it won't use any pesticides or chemicals, so the rooftop will be a haven for biodiversity.
For Agropolis, the Paris-based company that won the contract to design the roof, not only is the farm a way to help the city lower its carbon footprint by producing food locally, but adding plants to the roof can help cool the city dealing with increasing heat waves. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Discuss solutions for protecting and managing aging infrastructure at WIC19. Learn more at awwa.org/water infrastructure.
KC, our Facebook page. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
During the beginning of the 20th century, yet another unique American music form developed. When Mexican-American musicians from Texas began to play the accordions brought by immigrants from Germany and Czechoslovakia, the result was Tejano, or Tex-Mex music.